Welcome to All Sides with Anna Staver. President-elect Donald Trump has wasted no time in putting together a team that he wants to lead the White House for the next 4 years. Ohio's own Vivek Ramaswamy has been tapped to work on government efficiency alongside Elon Musk. And from Attorney General to the Department of Education, Trump's picks for his cabinet are raising some eyebrows on Capitol Hill and raising questions about whether his appointments can make it through the Senate, whether the Senate will do confirmation hearings at all, and how Speaker Mike Johnson will lead a small majority in the U.S. House. Here to sort through all things national politics this hour is Ken Rudin, host of the Political Junkie podcast. Ken, welcome back to All Sides.
Good morning, Anna.
It's been just a few weeks since the election, and while the results are still being finalized and dissected, Trump is wasting no time getting started on who he wants to lead the next 4 years. What do you make of the speed of which he's going? It's faster than he did in 2016.
Well, that, I'm just going to talk about that. I mean, in 2016, basically, he didn't know much about who these kind of people should serve in his cabinet or his administration, and he relied on many establishment folks to get his cabinet. And he would have these public lunches, like he would have Mitt Romney, who apparently wanted to be Secretary of State, and he had lunch with Mitt Romney. And then when he didn't pick Romney, he mocked him. I mean, that's the way he was doing it. Now, it seems like he's not, President-elect Trump, is not relying on anybody except his own instinct, which is just stunning to watch. One, how quickly it is, and two, so many of these are the last person you would think of to pick to head these cabinet posts. Like, I mean, the thought of Matt Gaetz, who's under investigation for sexual harassment and more, and paying young girls, these are just allegations, paying young girls for sex to be attorney general. So you're going to have, Tulsi Gabbard, who's going to be the head of national intelligence, who has said wonderful things about Assad of Syria and all these other dictators. And Russia said that she, when she was named as a possible cabinet official, a Russian newspaper said she's our girlfriend. I mean, these are the people that Trump thinks. Look, Trump decided from the beginning that he's going to run an anti-establishment campaign, and he did, and he won. I mean, clearly he won by a bigger percentage than anybody expected, certainly the so-called experts. And now he's picking a cabinet that is, again, what nobody expected. But I think Trump loves that. He loves that people just tear their hair out to say, I can't believe Trump is doing that. But I think the words, I can't believe Trump is doing that, are words that should no longer be spoken.
Yeah, let's talk a little bit about some of these nominees, because they really run the gambit. Marco Rubio for Secretary of State feels like a more traditional pick. He served on the Foreign Relations Committee. He's been in government a while.
Yeah, no, but here's a great theory. I mean, the theory is Donald Trump never forgets a slight. And of course, he and Marco Rubio had a battle when they were both running for the presidential nomination, Republican nomination in 2016. Rubio has been a strong Trump ally ever since then. People wonder, well, now Trump is going to take him out of the Senate, make him Secretary of State, and maybe get rid of him in 6 months just so he can pay back Marco Rubio. Look, that's kind of silly, but a lot of things. But the one thing you could say about Marco Rubio clearly is that he is a normal sounding pick for Secretary of State. He may be more hawkish on some foreign entanglements than Donald Trump is, but he's not a crazy pick. And I think his fellow senators would have no problem, especially with the Republican majority, confirming him as Secretary of State.
Yeah, he spent several years on the Foreign Relations Committee. This is not something that is unfamiliar to him. Let's talk about Matt Gaetz, the man of the hour. He has a number of allegations against him. The Congressional Ethics Committee met yesterday, decided to table it for now, meet again in December. But evidence from the FBI investigation, from the DOJ investigating, it's starting to leak. Like, we've seen this very tangled web chart of payments that Gates allegedly made to some younger women for sex and allegedly potentially for drugs.
Well, here's the thing. I mean, I'm first of all, I think this is the most baffling nomination that Trump could possibly make, especially as an attorney general, especially for somebody who's under such so many investigations. But here's the thing. The Justice Department has been investigating him for at least 3 years, and then they finally decided to bring no charges. Given the fact that so many women are coming forward and saying that Gates paid them to have sex and paid them, and they were at parties where drugs were allegedly used, and the Justice Department couldn't find anything to charge him with, and then the House Ethics Committee as well. I mean, you know, the fact that once Trump nominated Gates, Gates resigned from Congress, so which would shortchange, you know, any kind of investigation into him. But why would it take the House Ethics Committee since April of 2021 to come up with a report? The fact that, I mean, in fairness to Matt Gaetz, and those are words I've never said in my life, but in fact, in fairness to Matt Gaetz, if he was being investigated, isn't 3 years long enough to come up with a conclusion? But plus the fact that Matt Gaetz has spent his time mocking and berating and belittling Republican senators, starting with Mitch McConnell. Of course, Mitch McConnell is no longer the majority leader, but he's still in the Senate. But he's ridiculing all these senators who will be the jurors on his confirmation hearing. So, I mean, Matt Gaetz, I don't know if Trump did it just to stick his finger in everybody's eye and in the establishment's eye, but unless Trump does what he's threatening to do, and that is tell the Senate to go on recess so he can name his entire cabinet with recessed appointments, I can't see how he's confirmed by the Senate.
Let's talk about the Secretary of Defense, Fox News Sunday host Pete Hegseth. Now, Hegseth is a military veteran, but he also has allegations, and a police report has come out alleging that he sexually assaulted a woman at a hotel.
That's right. That was in 2017, and he denies it. But it's very interesting.
But he settled civilly.
Right. Exactly. He paid heavily, although he denies any kind of any crime was committed. But it's interesting that both, you know, not both, but Hegseth and Robert Kennedy Jr. and Matt Gaetz all have some kind of sexual harassment, sexual crimes alleged against them. And Donald Trump, who also has sexual harassment and worse allegations against him, maybe he went out of his way to pick people who he feels more comfortable with. But Hegseth, I mean, he's a Fox News contributor or a Fox News host, and he's going to be Secretary of Defense. I mean, that's just beyond. I mean, and then he also, I believe Hegseth has also gone on record of supporting combat veterans who have been accused of war crimes. Now, I mean, and this is the nominee for Secretary of Defense. So, you know, explain that to me.
Let's talk about Linda McMahon, Secretary of Education. McMahon has served for 1 year on a state board for education, and says that when she was younger, she thought about being a teacher, but her marriage got in the way of those dreams.
I thought about being a Secretary of Defense. I mean, just because she thought about being a teacher is hardly the reason to get the wife of the World Wrestling Alliance or whatever to be Secretary of Education. Now, look, you know, Donald Trump says he wants to get rid of the department, and why not, you know, have, if Linda McMahon is going to do what Donald Trump wants to do, well, Trump has promised that from day one, that it's a department he wants to get rid of. And Linda McMahon, sure, why not name her? But, you know, it would be nice to have a teacher or somebody with education background as Secretary of Education. But, you know, I mean, you know, it would be nice for a lot of things to happen, and they don't happen. I don't object to Linda McMahon so much as the fact that Donald Trump wants to get rid of that department, so no matter whom he picked as the person to head up that department, that's exactly what he plans to do.
You know what's interesting to me is Betsy DeVos, The last secretary Trump picked for education was pretty controversial when he picked her. It was a 50-50 split in the Senate. I believe Mike Pence broke the tie on that confirmation hearing, and we were all a Twitter about that and the controversy of Betsy DeVos. I wonder, you know, do we see that this time? Do we, or has he solidified power in a way that even Matt Gaetz gets confirmed?
I don't see Matt Gaetz getting confirmed. And if it does, then you might as well just forget about the Senate and any kind of advice and consent they're going to give. Because if they could confirm somebody like Matt Gaetz only because Donald Trump wants them, that just goes beyond any kind of presidential appointment in history. You can go through cabinet officials throughout, you know, the years. Nobody like a Matt Gaetz was ever appointed to something as significant as attorney general. So that's kind of remarkable. But you know, I mean, the Linda McMahons and the Elise Stefanik's and the Mike Walls, who's going to be the head of the National Security Administration, Lee Zeldin, who's going to be the head of the EPA. These are kind of conventional picks. And some people say, well, maybe he names some you know, outlanders like a Matt Gaetz or a Robert Kennedy Jr. or something like that, or even a Pete Hegseth. So, you know, then the other cabinet officials, you know, come out looking more establishment-like or more normal or more confirmable. And that may be the case because it's really, I mean, a lot of them, look, Kristi Noem, you know, who's up for Homeland Security, I mean, other than the fact that she killed her dog and she killed a pet goat, I mean, I don't, you know, we could laugh about that, but I don't think, does that disqualify her? Maybe as head of the Homeland Security, you know, she'll keep dogs, you know, and puppies from coming into this country illegally. But other than that, she's, you know, still a mainstream candidate. It's just the more extreme ones, the Robert Kennedys, you know, the people who have these conspiracy theorists, and the fact that he's very, you know, skeptical of vaccines, and that's, you know, that's kind of Mike Rounds, a Republican senator from South Dakota, said, "Wait a second, vaccines are saving millions of lives around the country." So these are very unconventional picks. Donald Trump is a very unconventional president, and I think he just feels like, you know, maybe I was a little cautious in 2016. But I'm throwing caution to the wind in 2024, and I'm just gonna name these, and we'll see if the Republican senators vote against them. Remember, any Republican who steps up against Trump, who does something that is not, you know, that Trump doesn't like, the MAGA movement is so strong in this country that they can make trouble for these political figures back home. And, you know, like, the, you know, challenging them for in the primaries when their terms come up. So a lot of them know that they, you know, you risk challenging Donald Trump at your peril.
Yeah. Lisa Murkowski, Susan Collins, maybe a little more insulated from that, but those are two votes and they have a 53 majority. Like Susan Collins, if you primary her from the right, there's a good chance you just give Democrats that seat the next year.
Well, I don't think there's many Democrats who wouldn't mind that. Look,
no, Susan, I know that. Collins,
yeah, but Susan Collins is kind of a very interesting case. I mean, I guess she was up. Was she up in 2018? I can't remember if she was up in 2018. But she voted for so many of Donald Trump's Supreme Court justices, all of whom, you know, called for the overturning of the Roe decision. And Susan Collins, who ostensibly is pro-choice, favors reproductive rights, she says, well, you know, I'm not going to be fooled again. So she said this so many times, I think people roll their eyes at what Susan Collins is going to do. But basically, with 53 Republicans in the Senate, you know, you have much more breathing room than you had with a 50-50 Senate or even a 51-49 Senate that the Democrats held in the last Congress.
Let's talk about recess appointments. This is a big deal, and I know it's kind of a little bit wonky procedural, but if Congress goes to recess and they have to go for a certain period of time, then Trump can make appointments and they will be good for 2 years before they got to come back and seek an actual appointment. And a lot can happen in 2 years. And this is essentially Congress ceding its advice and consent power to the president.
That's exactly right. And the Republican Senate needs to decide what to do. Now, when the battle to replace Mitch McConnell as Republican leader went, was going on the other day, and John Thune of South Dakota won it, and John Cornyn of Texas was involved, Rick Scott of Florida was involved, the three-way race, and all three said that they would consider the Senate having recess appointments, which was what Donald Trump may ultimately ask for. And again, any student of history knows that's never happened. Sure, there's been recess appointments, and they will last for the next Congress, which is 2 years. But to have an entire cabinet be confirmed through via recess appointments because they won't be able to be confirmed in a straight in a Senate vote is just, how many times have I said the word unprecedented to you when it comes to Donald Trump? But this is just. I mean, look, we shouldn't even talk about this because it's not happened yet. Donald Trump still has to wait until January 20th to be sworn in, and then the cabinet will follow. But it'll be very interesting to see what decision John Thune, who's a moderate, not a moderate, he's a conservative, but he's an establishment conservative senator who's going to run the Republican Party in the Senate. And he'll decide whether, the Senate should either cede its authority to advise and consent, as you say, which, by the way, is one of my favorite movies of all time, the Alan Dury book, or they go along with Trump and they just lie down for him. So, we could talk about what the Senate might do, but let's just wait to see what happens because I think there's a lot of things going on right now for Republicans who say, my God, Matt Gaetz has done nothing but insult us for the past couple of years, and why are we going to confirm him? But maybe Donald Trump just enjoys, putting them through that ringer.
Coming up, Elon Musk, Vivek Ramaswamy, and government efficiency. That's when All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
No matter what happens in Washington, the NPR Politics Podcast is here for you. For the latest news, insights, and analysis from the election and beyond, listen to the NPR Politics Podcast.
You're listening to All Sides. I'm your host, Anna Staver. Elon Musk has been keeping company with President-elect Donald Trump since before the election. His constant presence has raised concerns about access, influence, and how he'll shape the incoming administration. We're talking about it with Political Junkie podcast host Ken Rudin. So, Donald Trump is creating a new commission that sounds a lot like an agency, but isn't actually a new agency. It's called the Department of Government Efficiency, and it will be run by Elon Musk and Vivek Ramaswamy. First of all, it's fascinating to me that they gave it such an official sounding name, but it's not actually official.
Well, and it's also fascinating to me that if it's government efficiency, why do you need two people to run it? Every other agency needs one person to run it, but a government efficiency, you need two people to run it. Well, can I just, going back to one thing before we were talking about the cabinet, one thing I also wanted to mention also is that Donald Trump's personal lawyers have been named to positions in the Justice Department. So if there's any question whether Donald Trump would have to face the music for all the indictments and he was under, I mean, we all talked about this during the campaign, but he was under indictment for trying to overturn the government, for trying to fake electors, for trying to having national security secrets in his possession. By having all his own attorneys in the Justice Department, you know that he's not going to face the charges that that any other person would have gone to trial with. So once again, Donald Trump, doesn't have to face the music because by being elected president, and you have a compliant a Supreme Court that says he's immune in everything he does, So nothing changes. But anyway, going back to the efficiency in government, it's interesting because I think Ramaswamy, when he was running for the presidency, and even critical of Donald Trump on this, he did talk about for a long time that, you know, you need to cut the size of government. It's just, you know, overwhelming. And they're actually talking about, I think it was Ramaswamy who said this week that his goal is to cut $2 trillion from federal spending. And that's remarkable. Now, of course, is there waste in government? Of course. Has Donald Trump talked about cutting waste in government? Absolutely. Obviously, that you, when you have two conservatives like Ramaswamy and Elon Musk, you know, certain parts of the government will be cut and others will not be cut. But, you know, what's also interesting is Ramaswamy's name had been mentioned as a possible replacement senator for J.D. Vance, now that he's going to become the vice president and he has to give up his Senate seat. And Mike DeWine's knows that Ramaswamy's name was on that list of possibilities. But Ramaswamy apparently would rather, you know, do this kind of job, which he's perhaps even more suited for than anything else.
Yeah. CNN is reporting that Marjorie Taylor Greene is going to chair a new oversight subcommittee that will work with DOGE. So even though it is a commission, they are integrating it into the government a little bit.
Well, it's called DOGE. But of course, if you think of his bone spurs, maybe the word is dodge. Oh, no, that's a cheap joke. No, I'm sorry that we can't. We don't talk about avoiding the draft with bone spurs and things like that, because we don't talk about that. But you know, absolutely. And I think, you know, whatever you think of the role of Elon Musk, he played a significant role by moving Twitter into his personal, political, ideological, conservative, pro-Trump mechanism. He has, you know, his tweets have been seen by millions and millions of people every day. I mean, if you're on Twitter or you're on X, you're because of the way they design it, you'll see Musk's tweets more than anybody else's. And that he played a significant role in Trump's election. I mean, I'm so startled. But I mean, of course, I wasn't on your show shortly after the election. But my goodness, I mean, not that a Trump victory was out of the question, but by the amounts he won by the states he won. I didn't think he was going to win Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, and Michigan. I didn't, you know, when that poll came out in Iowa by that the Iowa pollster, Ann Seltzer, who said that Kamala Harris was up by 3 points, and everybody said, oh my goodness, maybe, you know, Kamala Harris is going to be an upset. And Trump wound up winning by like 13 points. There were so many more things that I missed, that a lot of people missed. What Donald Trump was offering the American people, and I thought that both sides had an equal chance of winning because of what they were offering, but I think just Kamala Harris was part of the establishment, was part of a very unpopular Biden administration. You know, when she said, I see no differences between myself and Joe Biden, that hurt. What I'm trying to say, though, is that Elon Musk and Donald Trump represent something that a lot of people didn't see coming, even though Donald Trump did take over the country in 2016, but there were still asterisks, there were still question marks. He didn't win the popular vote. This time he won the popular vote, he won the House, he won the Senate. He's hoping to ram through a cabinet that most people would thought that nobody would have the guts to do. But nobody can ever say that Donald Trump doesn't have the guts to do what he wants to do. And we're going to see something that we've never seen before.
There's also a little bit of friction between Elon Musk and Donald Trump's transition team. According to news reports, the tech billionaire blew up at Boris Epstein, part of Trump's transition team, during a dinner at Mar-a-Lago. So there is tension and perhaps concern about how much influence Elon has at this point.
Yeah, no, I think that's true. And there's a lot of jealousy as well. And I think Musk will have, you know, tremendous amount. I mean, the fact that when Donald Trump, the president-elect, has been on the phone with the heads of countries, you know, the heads of countries around the world, and Elon Musk will be on the phone with him. And he, you know, he has no authority. He has no, he's not going to be appointed to a cabinet position. And plus the fact that Elon Musk, as you said in your introduction, he has so many government contracts. He gets so many billions of dollars through government contracts. Is there not a conflict of interest of somebody who's trying to cut out waste in government for, by somebody who has government contracts worth billions of dollars? So there are so many things that we can say about the whole thing, but the fact is that Musk will have power and he will use the power. And I kind of think that Donald Trump welcomes that because he admires somebody who's rich and has power and influence. And you can certainly say that about Elon Musk.
Let's talk a little bit about Senator John Thune of South Dakota. He is the new Mitch McConnell, and we touched on that earlier. But what do we really know about him? And I mean, Mitch McConnell, whether you love him or you hate him, he ruled that chamber with an iron fist for a long, long time.
He did, the longest Republican leader in Senate history. And he was, it's not that he was a conservative, but he wanted to win. He wanted to get Republicans to win. So when I think of Mitch McConnell, I even go before, and I've said this a million times, but I even go before the Trump, before Trump took office in 2017, when President Obama named Merrick Garland to the Supreme Court, and Mitch McConnell refused to not only give him a vote, he refused to give him a hearing because it was 9 months away from the election. So he blocked Obama's choice of Merrick Garland. But when Donald Trump named, when Ruth Bader Ginsburg died and Donald Trump named Amy Coney Barrett just weeks before the election, Mitch McConnell pushed that vote through. So he was extremely powerful. There are a lot of conservatives who didn't like him, Rick Scott of Florida among them. They felt he wasn't conservative enough. Matt Gaetz ridiculed McConnell for years about his, you know, alleged weakness and a lack of ideological strength. But McConnell did what he needed to do. And of course, his health has failed. And so they put it up for, you know, for a vote. Rick Scott was supposed to be the MAGA choice of Donald Trump. Trump had endorsed him. He was more conservative. John Thune had refused to battle, refused to he basically went along with the election results of 2020 that Joe Biden won, and Donald Trump was always angry at Thune for that. And yet the he was a clear winner. To be the next Republican leader. The question is whether he uses that influence to make it a completely separate arm of the government, separation of powers, or he'll go along. But I kind of think John Thune doesn't owe Donald Trump anything. So we'll see what he does. But it's really going to be more about style and strength. With John Thune, because Mitch McConnell again has slowed down pretty convincingly over the past couple of years.
Let's move on to the U.S. House. Leadership there stayed largely the same. We're going to have the same speaker, the same minority leader, but we have our very first transgender congressperson, Representative Sarah McBride, or I guess representative-elect at this point, Sarah McBride.
Correct.
And
Correct. Of Delaware.
And there is a lot of controversy that has unfolded in the last week over what bathroom Sarah will be using at the Capitol.
This is, you know, I'm glad we're on the radio now and not on TV because you'd see my face like rolling my eyes. But Nancy Mace, a former Trump critic who now is a Trump lover, like so many members of Congress, she's a very conservative congresswoman from South Carolina. And she basically is pushing this bill through, and she d doesn't, even though McBride's name isn't in the bill, she cl Nancy Mace clearly says it's because of her. She's the first transgender woman elected to Congress, and she doesn't want Sarah McBride in women's bathrooms. And Marjorie Taylor Greene agrees completely. I don't want them in our room, and I don't want them in our bathroom, and I don't want them competing in girls' sports and blah blah blah. So Sarah McBride said, "Look, I didn't run for Congress so I could decide what bathroom I should be in. I did it, you know, I was elected to Congress to take care of people in Delaware. And Delaware only has one member of the House, so she's the only member of Congress in the House for Delaware. But Mace has made this a big issue that, you know, trans. And look, I think in many ways the transgender issue has is one of the reasons. I mean, there's so many we could analyze this to death, but I think transgender issues is one of the reasons that Kamala Harris lost. Donald Trump was very effective by telling people over and over and over again that the Biden administration, the Biden-Harris administration, all they want to do is to perform surgeries on young girls who don't want to be girls anymore, or young boys who don't want to be boys anymore. And I don't think the Harris campaign really had a good rebuttal other than the fact that, well, the Trump people are being mean and they're being nasty. And I think a lot of people said, you know, I'm not ready for this. I think there's a just, you know, I keep thinking that in 2008, when Barack Obama was elected, the country's mood of social issues and social progress had changed. You know, once upon a time, the thought of same-sex marriage was just unheard of. Even Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama were opposed to it in 2008. But that's changed. Nobody's against same-sex marriage anymore, for the most part. And yet, these social issues like trans rights played a big role in the election. And, you know, you see, even in liberal states like Massachusetts, New York, New Jersey, California, Trump's numbers, even though he didn't win any of those states, his numbers increased by a lot. And I think a lot of it has to do with issues or fake issues like trans rights. It's just amazing.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see how it all shakes out. Representative McBride has said that she will follow the rules set out by Speaker Johnson, how that will be negotiated, because it applies not only to the Capitol, but to office buildings where the U.S. House conducts its business. So we'll have to wait and see how that all unfolds.
Well, maybe Sarah McBride may be the first member of Congress who never has to go to the bathroom during her stay in Congress. It'll be pretty remarkable. Maybe that'll look. It's just amazing. It's these are such fake issues that somehow just take hold in this country. And I mean, just like when I think of the Nazis marching in Columbus, and you know, I mean, look, these are a bunch of like losers who decide to make a stir and get everybody upset. But they talked about it throughout the whole country. Not that Columbus is becoming a Nazi or Ohio is becoming a Nazi-loving state. But it just, you see something on the news and people say, oh my God, what's happening? And that's just sort of like everything is like, my God, what's happening? And how do we react to it? And so just as the Nazis, getting their attention by marching in Columbus, you know, all of the 12 or 15 of them, Nancy Mace gets her attention because there's no guarantee that they can even pass a law like that, you know, about use of bathrooms. But you know, it's the issues that come to the fore with the MAGA movement, and so far they've been winning on it. You know, it's amazing that it seemed like in 2018, 2020, and 2022 it was the anti-Trump elections, and everybody seemed to say, okay, no more Donald Trump. And then in 2024, my goodness, it just went the opposite way. Trump won almost everywhere.
Coming up, what President Joe Biden is doing in the final weeks of his presidency. That's when All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
No matter what happens in Washington, the NPR Politics Podcast is here for you. For the latest news, insights, and analysis from the election and beyond, listen to the NPR Politics Podcast.
You're listening to All Sides. I'm your host, Anna Staver. We're talking all things national politics this hour with Political Junkie podcast host Ken Rudin. And in our third segment, I want to turn to the legacy of President Joe Biden. He has 2 months until the new administration change takes place, and it seems as though he is still trying to get stuff done, including filling federal appointments and going after the DOJ, rather, is going after Google to force the sale of Chrome after it was found to be an illegal monopoly. So he is not cruising to January 20th.
Well, you know, it's very interesting. I'm fascinated by this story because the official word on Joe Biden for the most part of 2024 was that he did a great job. Thank you. Even though, you know, the debate showed that he wouldn't be strong enough to run again. But thank you, Joe, for your service. You did great stuff. And then now that Trump won big, well, I don't know if he won big, but he certainly won bigger than many people thought he would win. Then everybody's saying Joe Biden did everything wrong. He should have dropped out earlier. If he wasn't going to run, he should have given the Democrats more of a small D Democratic opportunity to pick a nominee rather than forcing Kamala Harris down their throat, you know, according to this argument. And now he's suddenly sending all this weaponry to Ukraine. And when Ukraine was begging for weapons for most of the last 2 years, and the White House would say, well, you know, I don't want to go that far. Well, maybe I shouldn't go that strong. And then boom, he's basically arming Ukraine with these weaponry that now Putin is now talking about using nuclear weapons. So I don't know. It just seems like opportunity lost is probably what I would probably call the Biden White House. He still has some judges he can appoint. He still, you know, make a big difference. One of Trump's greatest legacies was that he named so many judges to the federal bench during his 4 years as president that he got a lot of his key issues like abortion rights overturning did because of the judges he appointed. But so anyway, now I'm kind of souring on Joe Biden, that the things he could have done, should have done, should have, would have, could have done earlier in the administration. Now he's just trying to do it with 2 months to go.
Yeah, there's a question about how much of it will get done. And, you know, when it comes to international politics, he has reportedly allowed Zelensky to begin using long-range missiles into Russia. And I know we talk national politics, but, I mean, what's brewing over in Russia is a big, big deal.
Well, it is. I mean, some people say this could be the beginning of World War III. I mean, I don't want to say that so, la-di-da, but, I mean, there's a scary part that Russia has been... What Russia has been doing to Ukraine, bombing hospitals, bombing schools, bombing neighborhoods, that was just atrocious. And then Biden would say, well, I don't know if we should be sending them, you know, anti-missile missiles or things like that. And now that he's doing it, now Russia's saying, oh, I can't believe you're going that far after destroying half the country of Ukraine. So it just seems like he's responding late. And of course, there's the issue about Israel and Palestine and Gaza, and you notice that the U.S. was the only country in the Security Council to veto a ceasefire because the United States says they could only be a ceasefire in Gaza if the hostages are released, and there's no opportunity for the hostages to be released in the language that they were talking about. So it just seems like we're now responding, and he's just, you know, counting the hours and counting the days before he's gone. And I'm just going to wonder, I'm wondering now what we'll think about Joe Biden in his 4 years, and whether it was just a brief stopgap in between the two Donald Trump terms, and whether he really accomplished all the things he, you know, set out to do. And of course, nobody ever does that. But of course, you know, there was a lot of things with the infrastructure bill and lowering the price of drugs for seniors. And these are major things, but it just seems like a lot of it was half-hearted, or too little, too late. And yes, he didn't have much of a majority in Congress to deal with, but I just feel that there was an opportunity lost, and I don't know when the Democrats get that opportunity again, especially the fact that it looks like the Republicans will have the Senate for quite a long time. I was looking at the senators who are up in 2026, and it doesn't look so good for the Democrats. So I guess it was an opportunity the Democrats had in 2024, and they lost the House, lost the Senate, and lost the presidency, and I don't know where they go from there.
I will say the Monday morning quarterbacking has begun, from whether Biden should have dropped out to whether Democrats should have had an open convention. Everyone has an opinion, but Democrats are beginning to look for answers about what to do next. The DNC, for example, is looking for new leadership, and a couple of contenders have thrown their hats in the ring. How big of an appointment is this? How big is it to decide who leads the DNC? I mean, arguably, who sets the tone for rebuilding?
Well, that's an important question, and I think people are not realizing how important it is because with a Republican Senate, with a Republican House, with a Republican president, Hakeem Jeffries, who's the minority leader in the House, or Chuck Schumer, going to be the minority leader in the Senate, what power are they going to have? I don't think much. But you think of in the last 4 years, Jamie Harrison was the chairman of the Democratic National Committee. I wonder if anybody knows that Jamie Harrison was the chairman of the Democratic Committee. That's how ineffective they feel that the party has been. Whoever's going to be, I know Martin O'Malley, the former governor of Maryland, is one of the people who've decided he wants it. I've heard stories that maybe Rahm Emanuel, the former the Clinton aide, top aide, and former mayor of Chicago, former congressman, would also might want it. But they've got to do something other than just, send out statements, because right now the Democrats are still fighting among themselves. They're still trying to decide whether Kamala Harris blew it. I mean, I thought she ran a great campaign. I really did. And everybody said, well, she wasted all this money. I mean, she did spend $1.5 billion, which is just startling. But I think she did everything right, I think. But see, nothing mattered in 2024. Listen to me. I'm trying to wrap my arms around what really happened. You think of, like, well, the debate. I thought she wiped the floor with Donald Trump. It didn't matter. I thought that, the campaign, her campaign ads were great. I thought oh my God, all these stars are endorsing her. I think that would matter. Nothing mattered anymore. I think Donald Trump has just done something to the country, to the party that they want, that he represents a change that people suddenly somehow feel that this is what we need. Now, maybe they'll regret their move in 2 years or 4 years or tomorrow, but right now, this is Donald Trump's game and he's playing it. And Democrats really don't have an answer how to respond to what Trump is doing, because they warned everybody, this is what Donald Trump is going to do. This is what he's going to, he's going to be, no, he'll avoid the charges, the indictments against him. He won't be accountable for anything. They warned it, and yet the American people said, that's okay, I need a change. And Donald Trump is that change. He represents that change.
You briefly touched on the amount of money that Kamala Harris spent in her campaign, and that does lead into an email question we got from Pam in Columbus. She wanted to talk about the role of money in these campaigns. And one of the things I find so fascinating is in terms of spending. Pennsylvania was number one, Michigan was number two, but Ohio, according to an analysis by NPR, was number three. We had $731 million spent during the 2024 campaign here in Ohio, and none of it was about the presidency.
Well, exactly. Nobody thought that Kamala Harris was going to win Ohio. Donald Trump had won it twice in a row by 8 points each time. I think he won it, wound up winning it by 11 points this time. But that Senate race, the Democrats were so desperate to hold on to something, and the Sherrod Brown Senate seat, which actually I thought he was going to win. I thought Bernie Moreno was too conservative or whatever to win. And I thought that the Sherrod Brown had so many years of admiration and loyalist, and that he would eke out another term. But he didn't, and it wasn't even that close. I mean, I was watching election night, and I saw, early on, he was down by 100,000 votes to Moreno and even more. And that's where the money was. I mean, basically, if they were going to, you know, it's one thing to focus on Pennsylvania and Michigan and Wisconsin for the presidential race, but Ohio was a Senate seat they couldn't afford to lose. As it turned out, they lost, you know, we knew they would lose West Virginia, and they did. They were lost to Montana, and they did. But nobody thought they would, you know, beat Sherrod Brown in Ohio. Nobody thought they would beat Bob Casey in Pennsylvania. And it looks like they've done that, too. So that's why so much money was spent in Ohio. And again, what does money matter? I mean, Kamala Harris really outspent Trump, and she lost. She outspent Hillary Clinton, outspent Trump in 2016 and lost. So all these things, debates, money, TV appearances, I don't know what matters anymore. I mean, somebody said, well, you know, what elected Donald Trump is, he appeared on Joe Rogan's podcast. I don't know what works anymore. It's just startling to that the old politics, and maybe that's my problem, that I still remember the way it used to be and the way it used to work. And I need to remind myself that those old ways don't work anymore.
I do wonder if one old way perhaps worked, and the idea that the fundamentals of the race, when you have an unpopular administration and a country that believes that they are not better off than they were 4 years ago.
Absolutely true.
Can you ever overcome it?
That's true. I mean, of course, I'd make the case that 4 years ago, were we better off 4 years ago? Well, 4 years ago, we were involved in a pandemic that Donald Trump dismissed and belittled and said it's not a big deal, and, you know, have your hydroxychloroquine or whatever, and that'll make you feel better. But people now think that those were the good old days, that, you know, eggs weren't expensive and gas wasn't expensive. And whether that was Joe Biden and Kamala Harris's fault or not, usually the economy and inflation is not a president's fault, but maybe the Biden administration didn't have to spend as much to create this inflation. I don't know, but all the things that Donald Trump worked on and argued for, it paid off. Not the money, not the issues, because if you looked at issues, what about all the women who came out in 2018, 2020, and 2022 on reproductive rights? All these states that voted for reproductive rights, the Missouri and Montana and in Nevada and all these states, and yet Trump won the states anyway, even though the voters went for a pro-choice, pro-reproductive rights ballot initiative. So I don't know what matters anymore, but clearly Donald Trump said the language, had the right words, and the Democrats did not.
Yeah. Or at least Harris did not. I don't know, because if you look meant that, like, Ruben Gallegos in Arizona, what happened in Michigan, there was a handful of states where the Senate Democrat won and Trump won. But
let me just say, okay, I don't want to go point for point, but in Arizona, Ruben Gallego beat Kerry Lake. It was close.
Oh, yeah.
As a matter of fact, it wasn't until days later. And Kerry Lake was still denying that she lost the governor's race in 2022. Yeah. So she was far to the right. She was really considered an extremist. She was cruel she belittled John McCain and all the people who were, you know, of stature in Arizona. And yet she almost won it. So
go
figure.
I don't know. We have just about a minute left, so I want to ask you, of all of the unprecedented things that had happened this election, what was the most unprecedented? And that may, and I've given you like a minute to answer.
Well, I would have loved to have talked about who's going to replace J.D. Vance in the Senate. Could be Jane Timken. It could be, you know, Mahek Cook. There are a lot of people named, but we could save that for later. But what's the most amazing? I think just the enormity of it. I mean, again, he didn't win. I mean, he only won. The popular vote was like 49-9 to 47-something. But it was just, I guess, given all the things that he did, Donald Trump did, since the election of 2020, including January 6th, including his ways of trying to overturn the results, and yet the American people said they want more of it. And just, it's just startling and it's amazing, and we'll see where he takes us. I mean,
yeah, that was Ken.
Look,
go ahead.
I'm on a show in Ohio where that went 11% for Donald Trump. So obviously, some people, see things in him that are positive and optimistic looking, and we'll see what happens.
That was Ken Rudin, host of the Political Junkie podcast. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Anna.
And thank you all for listening to All Sides here on 89.7 NPR News.